Good afternoon. Call the House Education Finance Committee to order. And as members are taking their seats, I just want to recognize that we have some special guests who have joined us for our committee meeting today. This is National School Choice Week, and there have been some recognitions and celebrations in that surrounding that. And we have some terrific charter schools and students from those charter schools in our audience today. So I just was talking to some of them a few minutes ago. So I just wanted to recognize that Higher Ground Academy from St. Paul is here. Go ahead and wave. Thank you for being here today. St. Paul City School in St. Paul. Welcome, students. And Venture Academy. I don't know if the students are here yet, but I know they told me that they were coming today. So if I see them come in, we'll recognize them as well. So I just want to thank you all for being here. I was so impressed with the feedback I got. You all are loving your schools, loving your teachers, excited about your education, and that is just music to my ears, and I'm sure to a lot of the other folks here today. So thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it. And with that, we do have a quorum now. So I would ask Representative Marquardt if you have had a chance to review the minutes from January 27th, and if so, could you move adoption?
Madam Chair, the minutes as provided in this Education Finance Committee are always correct, have always been. So I will move the minutes for this meeting.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. And any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. Thank you very much, Representative Marquardt. So, all right, well, we have a big event that happens as part of our process of creating our biennial budget, and the governor came out with his budget proposal yesterday, so we are very pleased to have Commissioner Casalius with us today, and she's going to offer a presentation on the governor's budget proposals that pertains to our education funding for early childhood through 12th grade. And so what I would like to do is have her complete her presentation before we go to questions so she can get through all of it, and I believe she's indicated she can be with us for as long as we need her, as our committee time a lot. I will be strict about ending at 2:30 today because I cheated Representative Nornes's committee out of a little of their time. So with that, welcome, Commissioner. We're very pleased to have you here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very excited to be here and talk with you about the budget today, and I brought several staff members as well, so if there are some technical assistant questions, we'll be glad to answer those as well. So thank you so much for having us here today to talk about the budget.
All right, thank you. Well, if you would just do the formal introduction of yourself and then go ahead with your presentation.
Great. My name is Brenda Casalius, Commissioner of Education, and I'm ready to go, and I'll go through the slides pretty quickly. You have some other information in your packets that we've provided, that just further background information about the budget and the 7-point plan and where we've headed, and not to cover ground that we've covered before, but to give you as a way to reference some of the materials that we'll be talking about today. So I'll try to go quickly through that so that I can leave as much time as possible to the questions of the members. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
As you know, the mission of the department for the past 4 years has been for leading for educational excellence, which we can all agree, but also one leading for equity every day for everyone, including both students and teachers, so that we can impact the classroom very positively. And the Minnesota Department of Education sets policy and direction to distribute funds, over $20 billion biennially, including federal funds that flow through to our schools, and also provides guidance and assistance to over 846,000 children, pre-K through 12. We also have about 155,000 students that we currently serve in some sort of preschool programming, either Head Start, school readiness funding, or ECFE programming. And we have about 53,000 licensed teachers, 332 school districts, 148 charters, 45,000 students choose our charter schools, and we have about 15,000 children who choose homeschooling. We have over about 65,000 adult learners that we support as well. And then, of course, we have all Minnesotans that expect a really high-level, excellent education for all our children, and would like for us to deliver on a world-class education for all of them. As you know, and some good work that Representative Marquardt helped us lead in the last legislative session was around our World's Best Workforce goals and really trying to align a statewide system of public schools that are aligned to some goals that give greater autonomy to school districts underneath those goals to enact the things that they believe are going to be best for their children, but then to kind of be saying that as a state, these are the things we know research says matters and are really important, and you'll see that our budget priorities are reflecting those goals that we'd like to achieve. That's having all children ready for school and ready for kindergarten. We had great bipartisan agreement in 2011 on reading, and so we continue to strive for all third graders reading well by third grade. To address racial and economic achievement gaps, and I've heard this body say that that is also a priority of theirs. All students are ready for career in college and have earlier opportunities in which to access concurrent enrollment, advanced placement, and other career pathway work. And then all students graduate from high school on time. Those have been our goals, and I'm glad to say that we've made progress. And in your packets, there's a little cheat sheet on some of the scorecard measures we use with our MCAs, our NAEP scores, our Nationals Report Card scores, as well as our ACT. So where have we been these past 4 years? And you may have heard that I've said we've righted the ship. For many years, we have really tried to deal with this economic recession that we've been in and have been trying to help give schools the resources that they need. And we've been able to increase funding to schools over the past 4 years. But again, we're still at about 2003 funding levels for our students. So there's still a lot more work to do in terms of inflation. From 2003 to 2013, we've been able to close the funding disparity between our highest revenue earning districts, the top 5% of our highest revenue earning districts, to the lowest 5% of revenue earning districts, from 31% to 18.5% by 2016. Very proud of that. As a percentage of district revenue between 2003 and 2011, property taxes grew 7%, but over the last 3 years, in the last two biennium, we've been able to bring that to just 1% growth in property taxes. So we're very proud of keeping a lid on keeping down our property taxes and trying to increase the state share component. And you'll see that reflected in the budget recommendations we make as well. And, of course, we've paid back the entire school shift, $2.8 billion that was borrowed. And so that helps our schools be in a better footing and also to have healthy reserves for the rainy day. The first slide that I have here just shows a little bit that trend in funding disparity so that you can see how that has gone down. There was a high point in 1992 of 37% disparity between districts, and now it's at 18.5 by the end of this biennium. Also, you'll see a school trend here, school funding trends for total gen ed, state ed, special education, integration, literacy funding, CTE revenue, and the increases that we've made over the past 4 years. And you can see the differences there between Metro seeing a cut to Minneapolis and St. Paul, and then inner ring suburbs. That's mostly because of the integration aid cuts that happened to Minneapolis and St. Paul and the way that was calculated. And then our inner suburbs compared to the non-MET greater than 2,000 at 6.3% increase, our non-MET less than 1,000 with 6.1% increase, and our charter schools with a 3.9% increase, which is what our inner suburbs and outer suburbs are on par with, around those same dollars. So just to have that information there, and there are some additional slides on the state funding and the property tax in your packets. Our budget priorities have been focused squarely on two achievable goals that we've been pressing with our school districts. The first is to reduce the achievement gap by 50% by 2017. Of course, we are now in 2015, so we're 2 years from that measure. We have information in your packets on how our schools and our districts are performing on that measure. We send that to them once a year annually, and they've received it twice, and they know how exactly they're meeting their proficiency targets for students and how quickly they're closing their achievement gaps. And many of our districts are on track for that. The majority of our districts are on track for that. The second is that we want to increase statewide graduation rates to 90%. It's a very high goal. It used to be our goal was 85%. We've raised that to 90% with one student group with less than an 85% by 2020. So we are been happy to report we have the highest graduation rates we've had in over a decade. And hopefully in a few weeks we'll be able to release information about our graduation rates and we'll continue to see similar trends, hopefully. Minnesota is rapidly changing, and so that is why we have this huge focus on the gap. As you can see, just looking at the slope, even without looking at the out years of 2035, you see the slope of the line means these increases are happening rapidly. Our rural areas are becoming much more diverse. Our inner cities are becoming much more diverse, and we just really can no longer let any of our students be left behind. Funding for the future. So let's get at what we are proposing in the governor's budget. And again, there's probably 100 ways that we could all prioritize the dollars with the $1 billion surplus, and this is just the starting point of the governor saying, here are some priorities on closing the achievement gap and how we can help raise graduation rates. So we are recommending a 1% increase on the formula in both funding years 16 and again then in 17. This is a $58 per pupil in 16 and $59 in 17. That's $174.4 million. And that raises the per pupil formula from $5,831 to $5,948. Better early childhood is a cornerstone that the governor has had since 2011. As you know, in 2011, we added $4 million to the due early learning scholarships. We continued then to support that now with $56 million in each of the biennium, or over the biennium, to support early learning scholarships. So how is it different this year in what we are asking for? The governor has asked to have affordable all-day childcare and early learning for 3- and 4-year-olds by 2018. He wanted to open up access for 3- and 4-year-olds. So we're taking a comprehensive approach and looking at where are the dollars coming from both federal and state in our early learning programs. And then how do we expand those so that parents have greater choices and that they're more accessible and more affordable for families? As you know, we will be proposing in this budget including schools in options for parents. So statewide public pre-K for 4-year-olds, that's $109 million. It serves about, we anticipate, 31,000 students. It's linked funding, so all of the poverty aids and QCOMP aids and other aids would go with that. We anticipate starting in the 2016-17 school year because we believe that schools will need time to ramp up. We also don't believe all schools will be able to do this right away or may not have the appropriate facilities and may want to secure partnerships with maybe a local Head Start, for instance, to provide the services for the school district. So we're offering flexibility with schools to partner, and we also are proposing repurposing the school readiness funding, which is $10 million a year, into this pot of money, so because it didn't seem to make too much sense to have a preschool school readiness program and then another allocation on preschool and trying to align those two efforts in those two programs. We will meet the schools halfway. We recognize that it will take time to scale up. We have some schools that are already offering all day, full day pre-K. We have some schools offering half day. We have some schools offering pre-K some of the days. And we have some that are offering it for fee. And then some just aren't able to offer it or haven't gone into the business of offering pre-K yet. But because the world's best workforce requires that they have their children ready for kindergarten as one of their top goals, we thought it was important to continue to try to give schools the resources in which to offer pre-K, and then with that comes all the other funding that a kindergarten student would get, or a first grade student for that matter. Early learning scholarships, the way that we're proposing those change is that we would then, many of the members know, we have two pathways for our early learning scholarships. Some are going to schools and center-based and Head Start, and the other half is going to parent choice. What we're proposing is because we're taking care of Head Start, which I'll talk to in a minute, in the waiting list, and because we're having schools be part of our early learning package, that we would then would dedicate all of those scholarships to Pathway 1 scholarships. So essentially be doubling the pot of scholarships from 4,500 that go to families to 9,000 that would now go to parent choice scholarships. Just a note of caution that if we do end up raising the cap from 5,000 up, then that number would go down because there would be less scholarships available if we make it $10,000 or $7,500 for a scholarship, then that would bring down the overall availability of those scholarships. We also propose to expand 0 to 5. There's been a lot of recent research showing that the earlier you start, the better. So since these are targeted for poverty scholarships, we felt that it would be wise to open them up 0 to 5 given the new research. As I stated, we are looking at eliminating the current Head Start wait list. Currently, there are 2,485 children on the wait list for Head Start. That's $19.4 million. As a Head Start baby myself, I can attest to the impacts of Head Start and how wonderful it is for both child and family. And it comes with parenting and other resources and supports for families as well. These are our poorest families who qualify for Head Start. And then we're also wanting to continue Help Me Grow. It's a network of referral service for families to help get families and parents the information they need to be able to advocate and help their children. Other investments for this comprehensive approach, just to mention, they're not in the ed budget, but I think it's important to understand the comprehensive approach the governor's taken with early childhood education, is eliminating the wait list on the CCAP funding, the Child Care Assistance Program through DHS. So we're really looking at working families here and helping working families be able to continue their child care that they have for their families. And so we're proposing to eliminate the Child Care Assistance Program wait list. We also are continuing support to families through $2.6 million in the Minnesota Department of Health budget for home visiting. And this is the governor's interest in the maltreatment and the mental health issues and trying to really support families and give them the tools they need to succeed and support their children. And then, of course, you've heard the governor talk about the $100 million on the Child and Dependent Care Tax Credit. This is for middle-income families and young families who are struggling to afford child care. And if they don't choose a public school option, they're not eligible for Head Start or CCAP funding. This is a way to help them with those child care expenses as well. So that's multiple ways. And then, you know, last year the legislature added funding for ECFE, and that's on an inflationary increase. So there are additional revenues as well for ECFE in this budget on the base. Reading Well by Third Grade has been a wonderful bipartisan effort over the past 4 years, since 2011, I mentioned in my opening comments. And we've really seen great results with this initiative. We have had the incentive aid that's gone out to schools for third grade proficiency, as well as having students grow on their MCAs from grade 3 to 4. And we've seen our National Assessment for Education Progress. We've moved from 24th in the nation to 10th in the nation for our fourth grade reading scores. We've also been able to close achievement gaps 10 points between white and Hispanic students, as well as white and black students in fourth grade reading. Very, very proud of that. I think that translates to the great results we're also seeing in fourth grade math, just to mention. We're number one in the nation for fourth grade math, and we saw our black students go from 24th in the nation to 4th in the nation in fourth grade mathematics. So just the translation of the importance of reading for children to other areas of learning as well. So we're expanding our partnership with the Reading Corps in this proposal to be $10 million, so that we can encourage and support 14,000 more students And just as a point of reference, 95% of those dollars currently are going out to suburban and rural areas. And so we're very excited about the support that they're able to give our students. As you heard, I think we had a presentation for our regional centers of excellence. This is our new statewide system of support to support teachers around struggling schools and to help teachers with the looking at data, looking at interventions, helping them support students around the achievement gap and helping them with strategies to help students who are still yet learning English and students with disabilities. This has been critical that it's not a top-down approach but a come-alongside approach where schools do a need assessment and then they tell us what technical assistance that they need. Schools tell us that they've felt very supported with this model. And we've taken experts from the fields within their areas throughout the regions of Minnesota. So there's good relationships that's built on trust. And it's really about the depth of implementation and how well they are doing what they say they'd like to do and us supporting them in that work. And so we're recommending $6 million here. Hopefully, if there's a supplemental budget, a little bit more because we have a bigger need. But for right now, $6 million to allow and assist 200 more schools to be supported through our regional centers of excellence. We know that they're getting great results, and there's some additional results on our regional centers in your packets now, and I think we covered that in our presentation as well. And then we also know, and you've probably read the Star Tribune articles about the condition of Indian education across the state. If I was asked what is one thing that keeps you up all night, I would say this is it, that we just have to do better by our American Indian children. And Success for the Future is a program we've had in place, but it's only served 32 of our Title VII eligible schools. We'd like all of those schools to be able to get served so that 5,300 more American Indian children could earn their diplomas and have the kind of supports they need in school around culture and language in order to be successful. And so I'm hoping that this is a priority also for all of you. Again, the governor has been committed to ensuring that kids are, their tummies are full, especially at the youngest ages, and that they're not worried about a tummy and going to the nurse and missing instructional time because they're hungry. And you saw this with his commitment to kindergarten breakfast. And so we will be proposing to offer pre-K through third grade for our youngest learners free breakfast. And as you know, we already looked at reduced price lunch this past session, and made additions there. And now we're looking at expanding our school breakfast program so that we don't have food insecurity for our youngest learners. And I would just like to mention there was just a research study put out yesterday by the Education Commission of the States, and they talk about their recommendations and what four states are doing to close the achievement gap in this study. And I encourage all of you to read it, and we'll make sure we get it out to you. But almost almost every single recommendation we have in these recommendations are what other states are also saying are what we need to do. And food insecurity is one of those things that other states are doing for children. English Language Learner Program, we are wanting to expand this. We've asked for 4 years to go directly to 7 years because research shows to master the English language, students need support for 7 years. And this would, we did great work in the legislature going from 5 to 6, and now this would take us from 6 to 7. I think this is especially important as we continue to push more rigorous coursework and higher standards in our school, especially our new standards in our English language arts, which are very challenging, nonfiction-based, text-based, and very very rigorous. And so we think this added year of support for our students and teachers would be really important and would be a great lever in helping our English language learners meet our goals. Positive behavior intervention supports is an area that we've heard about for a long time. We have currently 478 schools getting support through this program. We've seen reductions in behavior incidents and also suspensions and expulsions from these schools that are participating in this program. We've supported teachers. Teachers feel much more supported in their surveys around this program. And it's a great way to reward positive behavior for students, to look at data and to look at practices that teachers are putting in place so all the adults in the building are on the same page. Very important to school culture. And it just makes such a big difference when schools are there about talking about their values and character and what they believe in as a school community is the way to treat one another and the way to behave in the classroom. We know but from the data that there are disproportionate suspensions for Black kids and Indian kids and kids with disabilities and Hispanic students, and we want to be able to give teachers the tools that they need to be able to manage those behaviors and the disproportionality of suspensions. So we think this is good. It's $4.6 million to give 600 more schools the support they need around PBIS. Also, we want to continue supporting our NAS Promise Neighborhood and our St. Paul Promise Neighborhood. The funding is going to sunset soon, and we want to continue on the promises that they're doing with the community empowerment to align services for families and for children in our Promise Neighborhoods around their early childhood, ensuring all kids are graduating on time as well and supporting those families. So in summary, the governor's proposal is $371 million total over the biennium. We're asking for a 1% increase each year of the biennium for general education investments. And we are doing a significant investment, $109 million in statewide pre-K. We're reforming our scholarship program to go to 0 to 5, and they would all be family-based scholarships, eliminating the Head Start wait list, working on supporting Help Me Grow, investing in third grade readers, investing in better teaching so that through our regional centers of excellence, raising the bar and closing the gap by doing several things, supporting our American Indian students through Success of the Future so they can graduate, supporting our kids with food insecurity so that they don't come with tummies and go to the nurse, supporting our English language learners program, supporting kids who are struggling with their behavior, and empowering neighborhoods so that they can make a difference for their kids right there in their homes. I can't say enough that this budget really does focus on kids, and it focuses on our most vulnerable kids. I know there are so many things to prioritize, and there are not enough resources to do it all. And we gave heavy weight to all of these things, but we've set some ambitious goals about closing the achievement gap, and we believe schools need the resources for those kids who need it most, and that's why we prioritize the budget the way that we have. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll take questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just a couple of things I wanted to ask you about and to get a better understanding. And I'm glad you went through in some detail on especially the early childhood initiative, because it wasn't clear from the announcement yesterday kind of how the plan was to allocate that money with pre-kindergarten to the schools as well as the scholarship program. So your explanation helped a bit. Just on the portion going to our schools and that, is that for all four-year-olds? Will that continue to be sort of an income-based program, so targeted towards low-income families? Or could you provide a little clarity on that? Because I know the scholarship program clearly is dedicated for economically disadvantaged families.
Madam Chair, so it's a good question. I think you'll see some targeting. So, for instance, a larger district that has more than one elementary school wouldn't have to put it in all of their elementary schools. They could choose an elementary school that's a high-poverty elementary school or one of their title schools. So I do think you'll see some targeting of the effort at the beginning while we scale it. So we built this budget so that it scales, because realistically, you saw the Senate number. It is expensive to do over the years, so we felt let's try to get our foot in the door, so to speak, provide some relief to those school districts that are already offering pre-K. They're ready to do that, give the others a year to plan and see if they could find additional resources to meet us halfway with that 5%, that half 0.5. and then work out any facilities that they have to work out. And then with districts that just really are not in a position to do it, how then can they use this year to partner and with Head Start and maybe pool dollars to offer offer programming and school-based programming.
Yeah, thank you. And so, yeah, when you mentioned partnering in that specifically with Head Start, I assume that then that would have to be targeted because there are right. guidelines on the Head Start program and who qualifies and who could take advantage of that.
For the Head Start portions of that, that's why I said there could be some targeting that they might do with that.
Okay.
But we're hoping that they would do school-based classroom in their buildings, that they would work to provide that if they're ready in the 2016-17 school year. And then in the out biennium, we are thinking that that will increase and that more schools will be able to find the additional funding to do it, similar to how we did half-day kindergarten. And then hopefully at some point the state will be in a position in order to fully fund it.
And then finally on the scholarship program, expanding it from ages 0 to 5. Now we do currently allow siblings
yes.
of 3 and 4 year olds who are receiving a scholarship to also receive one as well. Can you talk a little bit about the thought process behind that? I know obviously we have other programs and you referenced some of them, CCAP dollars in that, but just how what the plan is there and how you see that impacting delivery of really what I consider pre-kindergarten readiness services for a population of students more soon to be entering kindergarten, like our 3 and 4 year olds, where we've kind of focused our efforts with our scholarships.
Madam Chair, I think that by moving them to 0 to 5, what we are doing is recognizing the research saying that we start to see gaps already at birth if you have fetal alcohol or other things that put children at a disadvantage, and if we can mitigate that much earlier, that the research is clear that that makes a huge difference. You're not playing catch up in age 3 and 4. I think that with the ability to move them to 0 to 3, we open up and expand choice. Currently, I think just teen moms are able to have 0 to 3 scholarships, but we then would expand the option. And, of course, all of the programs that would be eligible for scholarships would have to be parent aware rated. So we still are highly valuing parent aware, and we would expect our schools to be parent aware rated. So we are, and they are now for scholarships. So we are very tied to high quality still and expanding that out. And we believe that this will just offer more opportunity for families, especially high-poverty families who have greater need, if we offer them earlier.
And one final question, and I'll turn to the rest of the committee members. So would a family receiving an early learning scholarship, would they be able to choose then the public pre-kindergarten program? So would that be an avenue where a scholarship program or a recipient would perhaps augment the other appropriation provided to the schools for pre-K programs?
Well, that's interesting. I know that that's how it works now with our Pathway 2s, that they get a slot at the school, but if there's a parent who is a Pathway 1 parent, they could choose their public school choice if they have the slot open in the Pathway 2. And I think that's something to continue to talk about how that would work, whether Pathway 1 could, I think they could still choose. I'm not sure it would be necessary depending on how the district's funding that. I wouldn't want it to look like it's a fee to that family.
Thank you. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Very nice presentation, and the clarifications are helpful. I just have two quick questions. You mentioned family flexibility on the early childhood area, and my question is, overall, is the goal to create a revenue model that flows through the family so they have choice, or is it to flow through a school-based program or a Head Start so that we're attracting parents?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Krishna, I think it's both. I think that's why we didn't propose eliminating scholarships. You know, we want to continue to support a scholarship model that gives families choice for that type of scholarship, but also give parents an option to be able to go to their local public school. For me personally, I live just down the street from my elementary school. My children attend there, will go in kindergarten. I would love if they would have had a preschool program there to be able to bring where there's a licensed teacher and transportation that happens, although I would have probably brought my little one there. But schools would have transportation as part of it. Compensatory dollars would flow, so they'd have other kinds of support systems like social work, counselors, after-school activities. You know, they often have after-school care as well that children can go into. It'd be completely aligned to the K-12 system. So I think that there are some advantages that some parents might choose. So this is expanding the market, expanding into public schools and providing support to public schools to offer pre-K, as well as continuing to support the scholarship model. So I think that it just offers up even more choice for families.
Representative Christian.
Okay, and thank you for that. And my second, just quick question, on the other investments, you have $17.5 million for the Child Care Assistance Program with DHS. The line item calls for 44.9, so I'm curious where the other $17 million possibly will go. And then you had mentioned the 2.6 for home visiting. You tied that to the child protection. Is that the only place we're going to do that, or is it just one starting point?
Commissioner.
I think I'd have to get back to you on that answer, because those items are contained in the DHS budget and the Department of Health budget, and I'd like to be able to get back to you the answers and not misspeak about how that funding is going to actually work.
Representative Friesen.
And thank you for that. And I the one concern I just wanted to make sure is that we're not using those dollars and calling them early childhood. I get the tangentials of it, but there's a perception there. I just want to make sure we get it right. So thank you for getting back.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that clarity. It's not exactly early childhood dollars. It's support to families. And so part of this, the governor's budget and frame, is that he's got a budget that's supporting children and families, because it can't all be in the schools. On the academic side, that there's a lot of other housing, poverty, mental health, all of those other factors, jobs, wages, that go into whether a child's ready for kindergarten or not and had the opportunities and access that all children have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Seltzer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Most of my questions have been answered, but I do have one question that I keep asking. This is a very impressive budget, and I'm very excited to see all the investments in early childhood education. And I'm just wondering, as we reach for that elusive 100% of children in need served, will this budget serve pretty much cover the four-year-olds in need, or can you talk about how we're doing moving towards that goal?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, you can see in the tails there's additional revenue there. I think it's $360 million or $370 million. Tom can say what the tails are, because we anticipate that districts will scale up and they will want to be in this, because the research is so clear that this makes such a big difference for our kids all starting. $360 in the funding year 18-19 for early childhood. Oh, the biennium, 18-19 biennium. So I want to be clear there. So $360 million. So we scale up, and the assumptions are that we will continue to see that. But I do think there will always be a group of, you know, we have 15,000 parents who are homeschooling right now. And I do think there will still be parents who are stay-at-home moms, parents who do not want to choose to send their children to childcare. So I think realistically we won't get to what we have in kindergarten, which is like 99% of our families are choosing all-day kindergarten. I think that what we'll see for four-year-olds is more like about 80% of families, 90% who want to still provide structured pre-K for their four-year-old.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to commend you, Commissioner, and Governor Dayton for this education package, because what I think is really exciting is that it really provides a focus, really provides a target on those efforts and strategies that we know have a proven track record of improving student performance and closing the achievement gap. And, you know, when you look at the early childhood education portion of it and all the emphasis on that, I see that as the real springboard for meeting all of the five goals of the world's best workforce. And we know if we can do that, we're going to have a much stronger economy for our state into the future. And so I just commend you for emphasizing and putting the focus on these areas that we know make a big, big difference early on. Couple quick questions, and I think it's pretty obvious, but on the pre-K now, I presume now schools would no longer be able to charge a fee. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, that is correct, that we would not, we would require in this proposal that they not charge fees.
Okay.
And then, Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the only other question I have is on the regional centers of excellence, and I'm happy to see an increase there, but would you, just for the committee, talk about, because I know that's worked closely with priority and focus schools and has had a pretty good success record, but just how does that actually work? I mean, we kind of hear about these regional centers of excellence, but so does, would a school go to the regional center of excellence, or the center of excellence goes to that? I mean, how does that actually work, and what type of personnel and resources do you provide there?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, I'm excited to talk about the regional centers. It's something I'm very, very proud of. And we designed a system that works with our cooperatives, our statewide cooperatives, to go in a region, in schools, and work alongside teachers, coaching teachers, working with leadership teams, principal development, and helping them understand and develop their strategic planning. What do they want to accomplish? We go into a needs assessment. Very highly valued on the relationship side of things, very respectful, and looking at four key areas, really. We have professionals and experts in mathematics, in reading, in EL, English language learners, and also in special education. We're looking also to provide additional support in the regions for American Indian kids, because we know many of our student body for American Indian kids are in are located in rural areas, especially in our high poverty rural areas, and we want to be able to provide them the support. So they go in, they do this needs assessment, they build relationships, they build a plan, and then they actually work the plan with the teachers, and they co-teach and they provide professional development around the standards implementation, around assessment and understanding your data and how well, around interventions if the school has PBIS, helping them implement PBIS around positive behavior in school culture, develop and providing support to the principal. We know how important leadership is, and helping support leaders in enacting that vision, building wide community-wide support for the school efforts that are going on, and just holding the adults accountable, holding each other accountable, not the state coming in and saying you're not complying and you have to write another plan or fire teachers. What it does is say, we're respecting you where you're at. We're helping you implement deeply what it is you say you need to do. We're providing direct technical assistance right in the school to teachers. And then we're helping monitor that progress throughout the year. And I think that's what's been most beneficial to those schools.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
We saw 52 schools come off the list that got statewide system of support. And we also saw about 85% improve in closing their achievement gaps and seeing larger growth for students. So where they're getting the statewide system of support, they're getting really excellent results. And teachers are saying that it's the right kind of support. It's not punitive. It's not top-down. And they've been very appreciative.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, looking at your presentation, and I'm hoping staff can enlighten us a little bit with a fuller idea of the data, but looking at your slide 6, and you're presenting a huge drop in the percentage of disparity, I'd like to have a table of all the school districts with this type of looking at a funding, unrestricted general fund education, because the very next one number 7 has a different grouping of funding, and the lowest group to the highest group is 35%, almost twice the disparity. So in order to better understand actually what's being presented, I'd also like that in a table that lists in the school districts with that type of funding, because for the freshmen here and people in the public, this is an example of how many different ways you can look at funding for education and just how different they are. Because then one page to the next in the presentation, the disparity is double. And that's why, with the complexity of school funding, it's not just as simple as, you know, maybe the numbers that you are presented, you have to dig for it. But I do have a query to the commissioner. In yesterday's presentation, there was some great results we've had from different schools and some shining stars. And in there were some notations, and I noticed on 17 here, and I'm glad that we're trying to address the need for the American Indian students, but yesterday there was some reference to a American Indian student education program, and I'm wondering if this is a pullout style that you're funding. Is it a augmentation, or is it a alternative curriculum? You know, specifically, because there's a lot of differences, and I'm just trying to understand how you're addressing it.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, could you clarify your question? Are you asking about the Success for the Future program that we currently fund? Okay, we currently fund the Success for the Future program for 32 schools. They're Title VII eligible. We're asking to expand that to 66 schools. It's currently a grant-based program that goes out and provides mentors and works with schools on culture and language and American Indian education and supporting American Indian students. But it's been dependent on adults writing a good grant to the department and us approving that money. And so it's gone out to 32 schools. We believe all schools that are Title VII eligible should receive the funding, because those 5,300 kids really need that funding in order to help give them the right kind of supports to graduate. And so that's what's within this proposal. We could certainly give you a lot of background, and I think there might be some in there, in their packets, in your packet, around graduation rates increasing with schools that are seeing this funding in those 32 schools. But I'd be glad to, Dennis is here, Olson, who is our Director of Indian Education, and we could provide you information on how those dollars are being used.
Representative Quam.
That's good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can I also, Madam Chair,
Commissioner,
allow Tom to just speak to the disparity question briefly with the two slides?
Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. The primary difference between the two slides is that slide 6 is the unrestricted general education revenue. So that's only the basic formula, the referendum, the local optional, the equity. Those are monies that go out to every school district without strings attached, that school districts can use for any purpose. And the other slide is a broader one that includes a lot of categorical programs that are need-based, so it reflects the compensatory and the special ed and career tech and literacy incentives. So it has programs that are more for a specific purpose or that are targeted at a specific group of students. And so that does result in wider disparities. And we could certainly provide a run that would show by district each of the two sets of numbers for you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Melcher. Is that helpful, Representative Quam?
Yes, Madam Chair. The issue is that the unrestricted, that ought to be flat, and that we do have, and it's appropriate to have funding for where there's need. But you've got 18.5% on unrestricted, which, you know, should be flat, because, you know, paper, books, you know, etc., should be fairly equivalent. And then if there's additional need where there absolutely are, you know, funding. So maybe if we got rid of the 18% disparity, then we would have, you know, equality because the other programs are as need.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam makes a really good point in that we should get rid of the 18.5% between the basic funding that we give to all children in the state. And I think that's what we've been trying to do, and that's what we were trying to demonstrate with this slide, is that we've gone from an all-time high of 37 on that basic to 18.5. Can we do better? Yes. Let's continue to try to enact measures that do better with that basic funding that goes out to students.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nice to see you, Commissioner. Thank you for your report. I'm going
to
build off Representative Quam's question about success for the future first. I don't know if we've recently had a report on the intent and the accomplishments of success for the future. So if you could provide us with that. And then when you move to 66 eligible school districts and schools, so those would be public and BIA and contract schools included, is that correct?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do not think that includes BIE schools. It does? Okay. So I'm going to let Dennis speak because he's the expert on success for the future about where our results have been, what the program contains, and our BIE schools.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, Dennis Olson, Director of the Office of American Indian Education at the Minnesota Department of Education. Representative Erickson, to get to your questions, as part of the supplemental materials, I believe there are some slides comparing our currently funded 32 districts, which do include BIE schools as well as charters. That follows the intent of the Indian Education Act, the state statute, which opens all Indian education programming and funding up to or open to BIE schools, public schools, charters, and other non-public settings. The graduation rate comparison between our currently 32 district-funded schools, as well as those which we would consider eligible, is pretty significant. We compared the two groups, those that are funded and those that are unfunded, and saw about a 5-point increase in graduation rate, a 5-point difference in graduation rate between those who are funded and those who are unfunded, as well as about a 7-point difference in graduation rates from those unfunded. And I should clarify there a little bit. My apologies. The previous for funded districts, let me just retract, was 59%, and we saw a 5-point increase in graduation rates for those that are funded. In the same, we see about a 6% or 6-point difference. So essentially what I'm saying is we have increased graduation rates for those districts that are funded. In addition, we have growth in MCA math proficiency. We see about a 5% difference with those that are funded versus those that are not. So,
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Olson, I heard the commissioner say that there would be an emphasis on culture and language when these grants go out. And from what I just heard you say, if we've had increases in the MCAs and we've had some increase in the graduation rate, why wouldn't the emphasis be on academics and on skills and knowledge that those children can use to go to college, to get a job, to have a career? Because that's what we want for all of our children. But, you know, knowing the need of our American Indian children, I think that we have a better chance to help them if we concentrate on the areas where I think you're showing success based on what's been done. So that's just a comment, and you don't need to respond to that. But, Madam Chair, I have a question for the commissioner.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, on the your proposal for the four-year-old program, does it mean that when you repurpose school readiness dollars, that those then will be part of the match? And I know this is voluntary, but will school readiness still continue as it is perceived and known today?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, if I could just answer the question about, and I apologize if that wasn't clear, but it is going to be academics as well as culture and language through their culture and language. So it's just being respectful of their culture and language while still prioritizing academics as well. In terms of the school readiness dollars, what we felt was that most of those school readiness dollars are going to pre-K. So it seemed like a double effort. So there was pre-K for school readiness and pre-K that we're putting in. So we wanted to align those two programs. So if a school is offering pre-K, they would then continue on with the new allocation of pre-K, and we would then take back the former allocation of pre-K. So we're really trying to align those two programs to the one program.
And then one last question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have current reports, accountability reports, on the success rates of Head Start and Help Me Grow that you could provide?
Commissioner. Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, we will absolutely get you that information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, Commissioner, congratulations and thank you for the changeover to recognizing the importance of 0 to 3. I know just a couple months ago I was fortunate to be one of 10 legislators from around the country that met at the White House with their the two top people advisors to the president on early childhood, and they stressed that, and then the next day we were at Johns Hopkins, which is now the leader on early childhood research, and they said everything has to be 85% of the brain development is in that period. And so I want to thank you. I hope we can even get some more money in there before the end of session. And the other thing is I did have a question on the home visiting. You said it would now include also the extra money for issues of maltreatment and mental health. And maybe this is more of a question that should be for DHS, but at the same time as the research on 0 to 3, there's also a lot of research that we need to have somebody, either the home visitor or the nursing home visitor, or somebody going in with them and actually sitting down and watching the interaction between the parent and the child, and showing them how they're either doing it right or wrong, and that's extremely important to the early brain, which then follows through. Would that also include I know in the past we have done almost none of that with state funds. I know a couple counties are doing some with their own funds. Would this get into that also in addition to the two issues you mentioned?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I can't speak exactly on what's in the Commissioner Jessen's and Commissioner Ellinger's effort. However, I know that home visiting is supportive of the family, and that would be supportive of all kinds of services to the family, and that would include mental health services. If they didn't directly provide those services, they then could refer out for that family to get the services. And so that's the whole importance of the home visiting program through the Department of Health, is that they then are supporting families to get the services they need directly. And also I know that within the Commissioner Jessen's budget, she's also recommending mental health services for the Early Childhood Assistance Program to go into child cares and help with mental health services. As you know, we did a doubling of our school mental health grants. Now they're looking at how do we provide earlier services to families with mental health services, even at the earlier stages of early childhood education.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm on the other committee too, so I'll ask them. Commissioner Jessen for more.
Yeah, she probably can speak to it much better than what
Thank you.
Representative Mullery, do you have additional questions? I'm guessing not. All right, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for the presentation. Having served on both Health and Human Services and Education Finance, I find that there's a murky area between the two, and when we come to daycare and assistance and health for 0 to 3 as well. And one of my concerns is that we don't use Department of Education funding to support daycare. If it's daycare that has an educational element to it? Should it really be funded by MDE, or should it be funded by HHS? And I think it's an area that we really have to clarify. And to go back to your first question, Madam Chair, I know when Senator Hoffman offered the bill to include education for all four-year-olds, that it's $460 million. And if I understand correctly, you know, what we're looking at is about a fourth of that, probably less if we have children, you know, from 0 to 3 that are included in that. But from what Dr. Melcher says, it appears that we're going to be building up to that $460 million to include all children. I'm making more of a statement than a question. My question is, as you had stated, Madam Chair, is are we getting the kids that are in poverty and the kids that need the care first into the program, or are we just going to, is it going to be hit and miss?
Thank you. Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I'm going to let Dr. Melcher talk about how we plan to scale it out with the percentages of participation over the many years. But I had a question for myself, wondering how long it took us to get to 1.0 all-day kindergarten funding.
Yeah. Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. The governor's recommendation is to use a 0.5 pupil weight for the four-year-old program, and also to link that to all of the other pupil-driven formulas, so that a student in the four-year-old pre-kindergarten program under this proposal would be funded similar to the way that we used to fund a five-year-old kindergarten student. In other words, a 0.5 weight plus compensatory plus ELL if they were ELL, plus if you have a school referendum, it would be based on that. Those would be counted as pupil units. It would roll into other formulas like, QComp would be one. It would affect basically all of the pupil-driven formulas, deferred maintenance for school buildings, achievement integration, et cetera. So the governor's budget also is assuming that, given the timing, this is a major change for school districts, that, and given the fact that we're funding at a 0.5 and not a 1.0 as the other bill would do. I think the other bill did 1.0 but then didn't have the links. That the first year participation rate would be approximately 50%, and we would see that scaling up over time to 60% in 2018, 70% in 2019, 75% in 2020, and 80% in 2021. And then if the legislature decided it wanted to go from a 0.5 weight to a 1.0 weight, that would be another policy decision down the road.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Melcher. But to get back to the, I think the basic question on this is, are we addressing the children who are either in poverty or that need assistance the most?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you for that question. That's, I think, the crux of this entire budget is addressing the kids that need it most and the most vulnerable kids. So I appreciate your question. I think that we address the Head Start waiting list, and those are the kids that need it the most. Those are our poorest families. So we are proposing here to eliminate the waiting list. The next group of students that need it the most are CCAP kids, our kids who are waiting so that their parents can continue to work. Those are child care assistance students, and through the DHS budget, we go for that next income eligible. Then our next eligible kids in poverty are scholarship kids, and we continue to support our scholarships by expanding those from 4,500 to 9,000 scholarships for that next eligible group. And then we have this new expansion into our pre-K in our public schools, which I believe most of our schools that have more than one school will probably phase in and target to their high poverty schools first, and then as they're able, they'll scale into their other schools as well.
Representative Newton.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Seltzer, I'll let you do one more quick question, then I think unless there's other burning questions, we've got a few other testifiers, and we'll thank the Commissioner for her time.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner, and again, thank you for this for presenting this budget today, and I think, you know, everyone has questions, but just there's a lot of hope for Minnesota's future in this budget. I did want to ask you, just a little tangential, so it's probably good that it's the last question. I just wanted to ask you, you know, as schools will gear up their preschool programs, and so we do have a shortage of qualified teachers, and early childhood often the pay scale is not as good as it is for K-12 teachers. Not that that is a tremendous pay scale, but that is kind of the reality. So I'm just wondering, you know, as you think out towards policy, are you going to be reaching out and, you know, looking for ways to, you know, maybe work with our four-year systems and try to get more qualified teachers that we're going to need in the early childhood area into the pipeline?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, this is a huge unmet need, yet still is around teacher supply and demand. We need more teachers, not just in the early learning area, but also in our rural areas, in elementary teachers and secondary teachers. So it's a very complex issue. I believe you'll be seeing recommendations from the P20 Council around teacher workforce development that will happen. For our public schools, they will be required to offer the same salary they would to any other teacher, because they would be a preschool licensed teacher in our preschools. So that shouldn't be a problem, but still, supply. I think, you know, for all teachers overall, we've got to get more of our young people choosing to be teachers. It's a noble profession. I've been in this profession now for over 25 years, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Seltzer. Commissioner, just one last thing, and we'll let you go before we hear from some other folks today. But just, do you have a sense of when we could anticipate seeing an agency bill? You know, the legislative language kind of fills in some of the details on the proposal.
I think we need to do that within 15 days. So we'll try to get it to you as soon as we possibly can. Be respectful of your time as well.
Right. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Ooney. We really appreciate you spending so much time with us today, and we'll look forward to having you back again.
Thank you.
And I did get a question from someone in the audience asking about the materials that were available today, and I've asked our committee administrator to put them on our committee's website so that the public may view them as well. So with that, we have representatives from the Perpich Center for the Arts with us today, and if they would come down to the testifier table. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I know you're still getting set up with your charts and that, but in the interest of time, I think whoever would like to start, and please introduce yourself, and we look forward to your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Susan Mackert. I have the honor of serving as Executive Director of the Perpich Center for Arts Education. Joining with me at the table is Dr. Carla Hines, who's Perpich Center's Senior Director of Education Effectiveness. I'd like to provide a brief overview for you today on the Perpich Center, knowing that we will likely be coming back, and we'll talk a little bit about the governor's budget and some things that we see in addition to that. But I felt it was really important to just give you some background, and the poster boards that you see, I just felt it was important for you to understand that we are statewide. We serve the entire state. You see on this board our professional development outreach communities, and on this one our arts high school, and I will leave it at that and go into my presentation. 30 years ago, legislators made a very bold decision by creating a state agency focused on arts education as a means to impact student achievement, contribute to the state's economic development, and position Minnesota students for global competition. 3 decades later, I can say with confidence, and backed by research, that the investment made has resulted in a great return for the citizens of Minnesota. Now, many of you are aware and may think of us as the Purpose Center as just the school, that magnificent arts high school. But from the onset, our responsibilities and our enabling legislation took us far beyond just the school. In fact, in the first 5 years of Purpose Center's existence, we were devoted to conducting research and providing impeccable professional development opportunities for K-12 teachers and teaching artists throughout the state. We author books, develop curriculum, prepare state and national standards in the arts, and we write state policies. We help the College Board develop an advanced placement, an AP course, in art history. We serve as a resource for other state governments right now wishing to capitalize on the creative industry. We lead state and national professional development conferences. And on a humorous note, we do work hard to keep our mascot, the Canada Goose, on our Golden Valley Pond. We have a lot of geese. We do provide, with the Purpose Center, very consistent leadership in helping school districts attack the systemic issues affecting teacher and student achievement, resulting in requests in each of the last 3 years from 85% of Minnesota's school districts asking for more support from us. We operate the only statewide public library, lending library with resources for arts education, pedagogical use, multicultural and diversity programs, and professional development. Since 1991, 3,300 students graduated from the arts high school. And I'm very proud to state that in the past 4 years, we have achieved 100% graduation, with 90% of our students generally going to college right from high school. Crosswinds Arts and Science is a good example of a school that we are now operating that shows our ability to identify and address the achievement gap. In a school where achievement was not satisfactory among our children of color, who represent 60% of the student body, we focused on academic programs and used the arts to reach these students. This past semester, 110 of the 193 students at Crosswinds earned a 3.0 or higher grade point average. School engagement. We've been honored with numerous national awards for our heritage of excellence in arts education, and most recently we're proud to be selected to spearhead the Turnaround Arts School Initiative of the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities. We are providing intensive work with 4 schools in Minnesota that have perennially been in the bottom 5% of schools on student achievement. I'm very proud of their staff and students. They're working extremely hard as we change their delivery and their program, taking a full holistic approach to education, looking at family, health, community, all aspects. I know we will turn these schools around. These brief illustrations really exemplify why the Purpose Center for Arts Education has been worth the investment and why we ask for your continued support. Now, since 2011, our revenues have decreased, while labor and operational costs have increased and demand for services have reached an all-time high. At the same time, we share a lot of the same struggles that school districts share in being able to properly fund an innovative high school. We do not receive any state reimbursement for special education, and where once biology, health, and physical education were solid 9th and 10th grade programs, subjects in schools, it is no longer the case. So we have students entering the arts high, which starts at junior year, unprepared to graduate. Our mission is to help them and to get them to graduate, so that 100 is not taken lightly. Now, I will tell you that we have become a very lean operation, and we embrace continuous improvement as a means to keep costs low while supporting quality programming. However, without additional consideration now, we will need to look at our programs in the arts high and continue some potential cuts in our outreach services. Keep in mind, this is happening at a time when your flagship Arts Education Agency is working with other states who are investing very heavily in arts education because they see the benefits in achievement and also in the emerging, rapidly emerging creative economy. So let's talk a little bit about money. Yesterday, we learned of and agree with the governor's recommendation of maintaining our general fund and providing $1 million over the next 2 years to through the biennium for facility instructional improvements and increasing the base compensation by 1.8%. However, we need additional funds for technology. For 2 years, Minute has been studying our technology needs and has said from the very beginning, we are abysmal. We have not had funds to invest in technology, and they determined that we needed $1,080,000 over the next 2 years, over the biennium, to really bring us just up to par. Technology for us is not a luxury. It's a tool and a necessity. And unlike school districts, we cannot levy for technology, nor do we qualify for those programs, that federal programs that come through the Department of Education. So we are woefully behind and wreaking havoc with our ability to deliver education. We'd like to do more online and other aspects of technology so that we can reach those 85% of school districts that want more help. We also will be seeking another $1 million in this biennium to support operations and outreach work needed for our rural school districts. We truly want to help every single school district that needs our assistance. And in looking at where we have been in this past year, we've been in every one of your school districts helping in one capacity or another, and we want that to be able to continue. We're very proud of our work. And we think that the investment in the Purpich Center is very pragmatic, that it provides great academic return, as our proven programs really will allow the state to directly address the pernicious effects of the achievement gap. And when I talk about achievement gap, I mean all levels, the top, the bottom, and everything in between. We are very good at training teachers in cultural competence and the use of arts education to motivate and engage students. It's a marvelous tool. Purpich Center is deeply woven into the fabric of Minnesota education. We've had 30 years to develop these programs, and we change all the time. We really look at ourselves as the pipeline for the creative class in Minnesota, which is why so many of our alums have jobs before they leave college. Colleges seek out our students because they know they can communicate, they know how to collaborate, and they're strategic problem solvers. So we'd like to use that expertise and continue, and we look forward to being of service to the state, to the students, to the teachers, to the teaching artists, and to all of you. And with that, I would like to ask Dr. Hines just to share a little bit about some of our outreach efforts, if that's all right.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Carla Hines, and I'm the Senior Director of Educational Effectiveness for Purpich Center for Arts Education. And I'm just here to just give you a brief overview of what we do in professional development and research through Purpich. We go out into the districts, and we work with our district curriculum directors and arts teacher specialists and general ed teacher specialists to help them with their curriculum alignment standards and assessments when it comes to teaching in and through the arts. We have learned that when students engage in the arts, they are learning the 21st century skills that they need to be successful as they move on into their college or career path that they choose to attain. It is through this that professional development and workshops that we have with the districts and teachers, that teachers are better able to help students articulate and utilize the skills, the contextual skills that they learn when they're engaging and producing art. So this is the work that we engage in with our statewide teachers. And we have, in my short tenure in this position, I've learned that we have more requests than we can fulfill due to our human resources that we have on hand. So there is the need is out there, and we're having a hard time fulfilling the need because a lot of teachers are learning that they need something else to help students connect to the content that they're learning. And they have studied and they have heard that it is through the arts that when students engage, that they are better able to ascertain the true learning that they need to have within that content area. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hines and Ms. Neckert. We appreciate very much your testimony. Do I have any questions from any of the committee members? All right. I would just like to say that, you know, there's a lot of research-based evidence on the connection between participation in the arts and student achievement, and especially the field of music and mathematics and that. So very much appreciate the good work that you do and your time today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We will continue to work hard on everyone's behalf.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, could we have a... You pointed out that we've been pretty stable for 11 years, or going forward, it looks like we're still going to do that stability. But you named a million here and a million. Could you put those millions or those additional things in writing for us?
Absolutely. And just so you know, you do have a handout, and it does give some information, not enough for the expenditures, but you have some information. And we, as I say, I hope we will be back so that we can explain in further. We are digesting the governor's budget and how we fit into that, and we'll go forward with some requests, and we will do that in writing for you.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, again, thank you for being with us today. And next, if we could have Erin Doan, Executive Director for the Board of Teaching, join us. And just to let the Minnesota State Academy's representatives here know that you will be after Ms. Doan. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, representatives. I'll begin today by just outlining a bit of background for you.
Thank you.
The Board of Teaching, just as a reminder, does consist of 11 members that are appointed by our governor. And at this point, their mission is really focused on a couple of things.
I'm sorry. Could you state your full name for the record?
Sure,
we have to
absolutely.
Have that.
My name is Erin Doan. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Teaching.
Thank you.
The board's focus is really to assure that Minnesota students are served by licensed teachers who are equipped to deliver effective instruction and meet the instructional needs of all learners. They have provided leadership in teacher education by establishing and maintaining licensure standards and requirements, approving institutions and licensure programs to prepare Minnesota teachers, and establishing and enforcing the code of ethics for Minnesota teachers. In terms of the state budget, the Board of Teaching, as well as the Board of School Administrators, really appear as line items on the Minnesota Department of Education's budget, though they operate as separate entities. So in terms of funding discussions with us, you're often really seeing us appear only when change items are submitted, such as they were this year. I also want to point out, just in terms of the board's operation and its link to the Minnesota Department of Education, there's often confusion between the roles of educator licensing at the Department of Education and the function of the Board of Teaching. So we'll take a minute just to clarify that while the board is responsible for the oversight of teacher licensure policy and teacher preparation, the actual implementation of those policies and the issuance of teacher licenses and administrator licenses in Minnesota is carried out by the department. So while we are separate entities that have separate allocations, there definitely is impact that's noticed when funding is lacking either on one half of that equation or the other. Minnesota Statute 122A09 charges MDE with the support of the Board of Teaching. So it reads, the commissioner shall provide all necessary materials and assistance for the transaction of business of the Board of Teaching, and all monies received by the Board of Teaching shall be paid into the state treasury as provided by law. Licensure fees are currently collected by the Department of Education and paid into the general fund. So the Board of Teaching is, in fact, relying largely on the allocation that appears before you. In terms of those funds that are paid directly to MDE out of the Board of Teaching's allocation, we do pay for rent, which does account for quite a large portion of our budget, in addition to general services such as phones, copiers, supplies separately. We work with educator licensing at the Department of Education to support the currently roughly 55,000 teachers who are assigned in classrooms presently, and a number almost twice that of teachers who hold active licenses in the state of Minnesota. We'll go back just a couple of years briefly for background. In fiscal year 13, a flat allocation at a level that was established in 2008 for the Board of Teaching was not enough for rising costs and state employee salaries, which resulted in an operating deficit for the board during that fiscal year of $19,000. During that year, we were assisted by the Department of Education to make sure that we were able to balance the budget. In fiscal year 14, we did operate with only a staff of four FTE to be able to work through the fiscal year while we were bringing a request to you here at the Minnesota Legislature for a $100,000 increase to our base funding. As a one-year increase to our base funding was approved, we were then back this year to ask for sustaining that $100,000 increase to be able to continue operating with our statutory requirements for the next few years. As of November, I am thankful and proud to say that we are back to nearly 5.85 FTE and requesting the base funding be continued to the $718,000 base minimally. In the interest of brevity, I just want to point to a couple of things that were provided for you as handouts. Among them, a handout on promoting teacher mobility, a full explanation of our budget request for the next biennium, and a handout on legislative priorities. I would like to draw your attention to two things, really. One, as far as legislative priorities or priorities in general for this coming year, really, I think there are a couple of points that are most germane to this group's discussion. The first is investing in teacher effectiveness. The board is concerned at addressing shortages and increasing access to training opportunities while maintaining high standards for granting full-time licensure in Minnesota. We would also like to maintain ongoing collaboration with border states and have begun to enter into licensure agreements that promote the mobility of licensed teachers, both Minnesota's teachers to our border states and vice versa. Outside of that, another priority is really ensuring access to educational opportunities by encouraging providers to recruit and retain more teachers of color to reflect the demographics of our changing student population, and encouraging the creation of new pathways for education support professionals and teachers of color to become licensed teachers. Finally, one of the lesser known or lesser talked about roles of the Board of Teaching in enforcing the Code of Teacher Ethics, we want to maintain safe learning environments for Minnesota students. You'll be seeing language brought before you this year that talks about adding a number of crimes which may or may not have really been thought of due to our modern technologies at the time that Statute 122A20 was first put into place. So again, in the interest of brevity, I'll not go through each of those separately, but provide those for your review. The last piece that I will direct your attention to is a handout that you were provided today called Board of Teaching Operations by the Numbers. Just really a snapshot that allows you to look at the load for staffing this year. Especially for teacher ethics, we're looking at one FTE, one person that supported the review of almost 450 cases of teacher discipline in the last 2 years, as well as just a little over one FTE that just does support the review, the and the discussion with our teacher preparation programs in Minnesota. There is information in there as well that talks about some of our alternative programs that have recently been approved, and I know that has been a question from many of you on what are we doing to take a look at new teacher preparation programs in Minnesota. As far as the budget is concerned, we were informed yesterday that the governor had approved a $200,000 increase over the next biennium. And I'll just take a moment to talk about some of the results of what we hope that increased funding would provide. And probably most importantly, continued assurance that teachers holding Minnesota licensure are complying with the Code of Ethics, and that those who breach the Code of Ethics or engage in criminal activity would have their licenses revoked or suspended, as the safety of children in our Minnesota schools is definitely a priority. Improved Board of Teaching oversight for teacher preparation programs to ensure program accountability is one that definitely will be supported by the investment in our new electronic monitoring systems. Continued negotiation with border states, as I mentioned, for teacher mobility to address shortages while maintaining high standards. Allowing for new collaborations to improve the recruitment and retention of qualified teacher candidates prepared to teach in 21st century Minnesota classrooms. We hope to provide more individually tailored feedback to support institutions and improve their teacher preparation programs rather than continue to stay focused primarily on accountability. And finally, to ensure that programs are responsive to current standards and policies designed to improve quality of instruction for all Minnesota's children. Because the Board of Teaching's budget is a fairly small one in relation to many of the others that are before you today, it is the hope of the board that we remember that any decisions that would impact reporting systems or large changes, there are many ideas before you during this session, large changes for the way we look at teacher licensing in Minnesota do have fiscal implications for a small staff, and would be happy to talk with any of you about some of those ideas as we move forward to make sure that we're able to sustain and support your work going forward. And with that, I thank you for the opportunity and would entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Doan. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Ms. Doan, talking about rent, do you pay the rent to the Department of Education or to the Department of Administration?
Ms. Doan.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we are supported with our fiscal services by the Department of Education, and money is withdrawn from our budget immediately when it comes in. So, frankly, to the Department of Education.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Ms. Doan, do you have the opportunity to approve or not approve the amount that it's almost $50,000.
Ms. Doan, or I'll add, even negotiate that rate to build on her question.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, no, in fact, we don't. The rent rate, though, is set by an equation used by MMB, so it's. I don't think anyone at the department would be dreaming up that number to hand to us on their best-case scenario. What I do know, though, is that, no, we don't have the ability to negotiate that. That is a set amount and one that we've continued to pay in order to stay connected with educator licensing. Because our work is so closely intertwined, being in a separate location would hinder any of the streamlining that we've already done to move those processes forward.
Madam Chair, Ms. Doan, so I think you just answered my question. So you are located within the Department of Education?
Ms. Doan.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we are located and housed within the Department of Education building. I might also add that as in fiscal year 13, because of that rent relationship and a number of support structures, if the board has had a fiscal shortcoming for a year, very often the department does provide that support role. Not that we want to ask them to be in that role all the time, but there is a reciprocal relationship.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Doan. I know we'll be hearing from you later on yet this session, but we appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, and now we have the superintendent of Minnesota State Academies, Brad Harper.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. This is my third year appearing before various committees, and I'm beginning to understand the process a little bit more, although I still make more than a few faux pas in terms of presentation style and content. My name is Brad Harper, superintendent of the State Academies in Faribault. When I say state academies, I mean the School for the Deaf and the School for the Blind. Two different schools. Both of those are identified in statute. What I'd like for you to do is to change your thinking a little bit. We're the state academies. We have two schools. And they're special ed sites. They're not general ed sites. They're special ed sites. One school for children with hearing loss, one school for children with visual loss. Then we have those unique students that have started to enroll more frequently, which are students that have both hearing loss and visual loss. So that presents some interesting struggles for programming, effective programming. So change your thinking a little bit. We're not a mainstream school. We're not a general ed school. It's a special ed site. And with that comes additional responsibilities that mainstream schools do not have. This afternoon's presentation is similar to this morning's presentation, last on the agenda. Time is crunching, so I'm going to try to pick up speed a little bit here. We do not participate in any of the funding formulas that are out there. We don't participate in the general ed funding formula. We don't participate in the special ed funding formula. We get generally one allocation each year. It's $11.9 million this year. Should be $11.9 next year with an increase of 1.8% with the governor's budget, which we're thrilled to have. The next question people are going to ask is, oh, that's a lot of money. How many kids do you have? Probably 300, 400. Wrong. 175. Whoa. Do the math. That's an expensive program. Yeah, it is. But what do we compare it to? We don't have good comparables in the state. The closest we come to comparables are the intermediate districts that surround the metro area, 287, 916, 917. When you look at comparable high demand students in those programs and you look at the costs that they that the districts charge to the home district, what do you come up with for an average? $64,832. That's based on 429 invoices from the Department of Education for 13-14. Our cost, if you divide 11.9 by 175, is about $68,857 per kid. We're $4,000 more than the intermediate districts. But we live in that low-cost area of Faribault. So that helps a little bit. But additionally, we're a residential program. So we have residential costs that intermediate districts do not have. So we're a good bang for the buck. We also receive asset preservation funds. And if you have an opportunity to come down and see us, and Representative Denver's not here, but he's a Faribault kid and has been through the campuses, you'll find that we have a couple of buildings that are on the National Register of Historic Places. Those are some of our older buildings. With age comes additional need in terms of asset preservation. And our physical plant manager likes to curse at me because we have a limited amount of money for asset preservation. And it's just one of those things that happens. We've been around for a long time. The School for the Deaf just celebrated their 150th anniversary. 150 years ago, that's Civil War. Representative Marquardt may tell you a story about some of our ancient equipment that surpassed any longevity issues that anyone could expect. And this committee helped us rebuild some of our food service equipment several years ago, and we much appreciate that. So one of the things that, I hope you take away from this presentation, that we're different. We're a different setting. We're a special ed site. We're also a state agency. State agencies in education, that's a bad mix under the best of circumstances. But we make it work. Our goal is to provide the best education for these high-demand kids. Last thing I want to say to you is we are no cost to the resident districts. So now that's a big savings for those children that are cognitively delayed, that have medical issues, that are unable to move without wheelchair or assistance. So that's a real positive contribution to the state's educational options. So with that, I'll gladly take any questions. But before you ask any questions, please come down and see the campuses. It's a wonderful, wonderful environment, and I'd be glad to show you around. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be glad to take some questions.
Thank you, Superintendent Harper, and I will take you up on that. And my office will coordinate with you. Would love to come down, and I'll invite committee members to join me. Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I always appreciate Mr. Harper's presentations here. And if members of you are on the committee the last 2 years, just to show how frugal Mr. Harper is, they had a stove and oven that needed to be replaced. They dared to come to us asking to replace an oven that was back to the Coolidge administration. I thought every 90 years or so we should be able to replace an oven or so, but that's how I think it went back to the 20s.
Mr. Harper.
It was old.
So anyway, it's thank you so much, and I, you know, what you do down there is fantastic. So
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Yes, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we get printout of how the governor's proposal affects the individual districts? Is that possible? I'm looking at Mr. Strom.
I was going to say, that's a Mr. Strom question.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, we're happy to put a 1% on the formula printout together for you pretty quick here. We're not going to be able to do a good printout of the early childhood money, I'm afraid, on a per pupil basis. We're really going to have to guess about where those kids will be. So that may be that'll be a large amount of money that is not able to probably go on the printouts, at least for the first round, unless we get some guidance from the department on that.
Thank you, Representative Newton. And I, you know, also was the prompt for my question to the commissioner, because some of those details I think we can't really put, you know, in that form until we have the legislative language. So, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a quick request again, I think, to staff. One of the sheets I have here talks about creating a free voluntary pre-K program. And yet with the 0.5 funding formula, it's not going to be free to somebody. Any way to come up with a cost to the school districts on an average basis of what this would cost them with the current funding formula?
Or Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we will see what we can do on this front. We certainly know the number of four-year-olds by district, but again, we may be involved in some pretty heroic assumptions in order to guess who's going to participate. And but essentially, the way that works is the district will be matching that. So if the state's contributing half, the district will be contributing half, but we just don't know what the state's half per district will be.
Representative Mansell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quickly, you know, as a committee, we should take every advantage afforded to us to end our hearings feeling good about each other and feeling good about Minnesota. And I don't know about the rest of you, but the groups and the programs and the things that we learned today are the kinds of things that really make Minnesota quite separate and better. And all the talk about economic development and having businesses and workforce development, it's amenities probably isn't the proper word, but it's programs and services that we provide to our citizens here in Minnesota that make us most attractive to people from other parts of the country and the world. So, good job.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. Not that I had much to do with that, but I appreciate
take all the credit.
I'll take
it. Together.
Thank you. All right. Well, Mr. Harper, thank you very much, and I look forward to my tour and to getting down on your campuses. And again, I'll let members know when we set that up, because I welcome company, and I appreciate you being here. Thank you to the committee. We are adjourned, but we will resume our discussion of the governor's budget and invite testimony from those who wish to do that tomorrow. Thank you. We are adjourned.